Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here this morning. We do have a number of bills for a public hearing and possible work sessions. Due to some of the bills that we have today that are member-sponsored, I will be taking some of the testimony out of order just to get them in and out so they can go back to their other duties, and we'll be continuing taking testimony on those bills at an appropriate time during today's meeting. With that, we're going to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 315. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 315 authorizes a court to impose a special condition of probation requiring a person convicted of stalking or violating a stalking protective order from residing within 3 miles of the victim. The bill creates three exceptions that describe circumstances in which the court may not impose this condition. First, if the probationer is required to reside in a county with a population less than 130,000. Second, the probationer may demonstrate that residing within 3 miles of the victim would not jeopardize the safety and welfare of the victim or a family member of the victim. Finally, the probationer may demonstrate that the prohibition would deprive the probationer of a residence that would be materially significant in the aid of rehabilitation. We do not yet have the paperwork, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Senator Winters, how are you doing this morning?
Very well, thank you. And thank you, Chair Pergensky, for hearing Senate Bill 315. And I have with me this morning Marion County Sheriff Jason Myers, who actually has worked with me on Senate Bill 315. Senate Bill 315 came to me from one of my constituents here in Marion County, and the good sheriff was familiar with all the background of the particular case and the issues. So it's correct that this bill creates the ability for the courts to add a provision to set a special condition of release following a stalking conviction or for violating a stalking order. Now, I'll let the good sheriff, Jason Myers, fill you in on the context of this and why we need this particular bill.
I think she did.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm a Marion County Sheriff. This was an unfortunate situation, and I'm not going to go into too many details, but an individual living within Marion County, several individuals in the neighborhood had a dispute with a neighbor who was ultimately stalking. A stalking order was issued by a judge. This individual, because of the way that the stalking order is structured, wasn't ordered to move and still resided near these folks in the community and continued to harass them. And so the situation has resolved itself over the years, but the constituents came forward because of the, I guess, the magnitude of the harassment that was going on over the years, and really wanted to try to do something with a stalking order that could help people in the future if they found themselves in a similar situation. And this provision would allow a judge to order somebody to move. We do it similarly, I believe, with sex offenses. So there are other provisions in statute that allow a judge or parole and probation to move an individual if there is an issue of community safety.
All right. Thank you. Questions. I'm going to come up with some questions. I want to see if anyone else has. So, Jason, I understand this is a specific situation that this has arisen from. Am I looking at it? I have some concern as to the breadth of it, as to 3 mile radius for some place. I mean, clearly within the state, there that would actually displace people completely out of a community based on the size of the community. I'm also curious as to what and why the court was not able to deal with this particular situation on an individual basis. It would seem to me that they could modify their stalking order, or if it was a probation that they were under, they could give special conditions of probation.
So in this, Senator Przanski, in this particular situation, as I looked into it, it was court probation, and the deputy district attorney that handled the actual criminal side of it, this was the most they could do was with the stalking order, and the individual, they didn't feel that they had the ability to force the individual to move. So that question is probably a little bit out of my swim lane, because I don't delve into that portion of the law, but that's my understanding.
Okay. Well, we'll look at this as to trying to figure a way of narrowing it, as to it may be if it's deemed appropriate to ensure that a judge he or she would have that authority to do that. To me, this is a case-by-case base situation, and that it should be tailored by the judge based on the facts that they have, as compared to trying to do something uniformly across the state, because I think we could have many unintended consequences through that approach, knowing that our communities are very small and very large.
Yeah, I think in talking with the constituent, that's what they would want, is the ability on a case by case, not that it would be.
Okay. Well, what we'll do is we'll confirm with the courts, the judicial branch, to make certain they don't feel that they already have that. It seems to me that's an inherent power of a court, of the judge, to be able to fashion a sanction and a sentence based on the needs on that particular case. If that's not the case, then it would be pretty straightforward to just call out that in these particular type of cases, the court does have that power and authority. Would that be adequate?
It would be, Senator Pogranski. It's just that we wanted to try to make certain we tighten up, if the loophole existed, that it's tightened up enough so that individuals and communities should feel safe. This particular case went on for years. It was not just a one incident. And it was not just a one incident before the court. It was so egregious, where you're talking about that there were firearms involved. There was issue of children not being able to actually go along the road. We're talking about a very, and it was one where, quite honestly, the family that was involved, the victims were feeling extremely threatened, both the male, female, and their children. So that was the genesis, and it wasn't one that were, okay, you have the order, and then there's the compliance. And in this case, there wasn't the compliance. So that was the reason for bringing it forward.
And see, this is the part I don't understand, because as a prosecutor, I would be advocating to the court that someone's violated their orders and asking the court to sanction them based on the violation, not, let alone based on what I'm hearing, potentially new crimes that could have been charged against them for conduct that occurred in that situation. But I know, Jason, you've been very busy, so we didn't have a chance to talk beforehand. More than willing to work and trying to figure out if we can get something together. We have some opportunities with some other bills. I looked at the relating clause on this. It's very narrow as to dealing with residencies. And I think some of the other things that we were looking at is having enhanced sanctions and penalties available to the court where someone continues to violate with mandatory minimums. So any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 315? Not seeing, we're going to go and close the public hearing on 315. I do have another member here, Senator Beyer. I think you're here on Senate Bill 977. I'm going to open up a public hearing to take your testimony so you can move on to your other duties.
Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 977 makes changes to the statute governing non-competition agreements. Under this measure, all non-competition agreements would be void, except those prohibiting contact between a former employee and customers or clients for a period of 6 months after separation. The current allowable period for the non-competition agreements is 18 months. There's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
All right, before we take testimony, I just want to call out again on Senate Bill 315. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony? I want to make certain if you're here to wanting giving testimony, we'll come back to it. I don't want to make certain that you don't leave thinking that we're not going to take testimony. I don't see anyone, so we will officially close the public hearing on 315 since there's no one else who wants to testify. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6. Mr. Chair, members, this bill that I'm bringing to you this morning has to do, as your staff said, with eliminating, I think, very intrusive non-compete agreements on employees. And I want to be real clear, this is only on employees. This is not non-compete agreements between businesses that were sold or something like that. So we're only talking about employees here. Current law allows an employer to impose an 18-month non-compete agreement. It's a fairly lengthy time. It's very strong compared to what other states have. I would note for the record that our state to the south of us, California, has eliminated non-compete agreements completely a number of years ago. What this one does is, let me start out and say, the purpose of a non-compete agreement is really to protect an employer's interest in trade secrets. And one of the things that you should know is that even without this, Oregon has one of the strongest trade secret protection statutes in of all the 50 states. I mean, you're very easy or very strong protections in place. And in fact, a trade secret is almost exactly what a business declares as a trade secret. There's very little difference there in that. I ran into a lot when I was with the PUC. It seemed like everything I ever submitted, they labeled a trade secret. And unless you challenge it in court, it is a trade secret, and the court provides strong protections. The reason I brought this is over the years I've watched this in terms of people feeling like they didn't have access to change jobs. It really came home to me just before we came into session, a constituent who'd been in the insurance business for over 20 years and was very happy and very successful businessman, had signed one when he started with the company that he worked with, and over the recent times, the company had changed their policies and changed their business practices to the point where he was very uncomfortable working for the company. He didn't feel in good faith that he could sell their products or represent that. So he quit and was seeking to go to change to another insurance company, different practices. And what he found is that that non-compete agreement he had, even if the company would have been, if he went and tried to ask them to release it, if they wouldn't, other companies wouldn't talk to him because of the potential threat from another business getting in the way of that. And I think that's, in that business particularly, it probably is not very likely that you could have something that everybody else in the business didn't already know about in practice. I think it was a really good example to me of where non-compete agreements didn't make any sense at all. I think you'll probably hear from others in the business community that they worked hard on developing the current non-compete agreements 15 years ago or so. And there are some that are worried about that, that someone could move across town, maybe working for a shoe company, a competing one with design knowledge. But I would emphasize again that this does nothing to limit a company's ability to protect their business interest. All it says is, and in fact it goes beyond that, it says if you leave a business at least for 6 months, you can't even talk to your past customers or clients about a business interest. It protects that. 6 months is a reasonable amount of time for someone, for a business. If you're using the insurance example, if they can't protect those customers they had before in 6 months, they probably ought to lose them, in my opinion. And that's just good business practices. You ought to be secure your customers. 6 months is a good, reasonable timeline. 18 months is too long. And think about it from the context of an employer. I guess think of yourself, those who are still employed. If you chose to leave your employment and you were restricted, you couldn't go out and make a living, although under the agreement it says that they have to compensate you at 50% of your prior wages if they want to enforce a compete agreement, or 50% of the medium wage for the state. Still, taking a 50% pay cut at best is a pretty devastating in most families' incomes. So I think that's an unreasonable imposition. The threat that this will damage Oregon's business economy, I think, is probably not realistic when you compare it to the fact that California doesn't allow them at all, and they don't exactly have a declining economy down there, particularly if you look at the biotech or the technology industries. People move all over the place down there, and it seems to work for them. They don't need this protection. So from the interest of employees and the ability of just reasonable Oregonians to move among their jobs, I think it makes sense to restrict our non-compete agreements to, as I've proposed in this bill, and protect the other business interests with strong protection. So, Mr. Chair, that's it.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Senator Beyer? Senator Lithicum first.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. The language in this says it voids all existing non-compete agreements. Is that true?
It voids existing non-compete agreements.
And you don't see any, per your testimony, you're envisioning there's no downside to that, taking all the non-compete agreements that are in existence and voiding them?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think the downside would be if if you had an employee who left and you perceived that they were using the information they had, you know, sales information or trade secrets, you would have to get an injunction. But I think you'd have to do that anyway if you wanted to stop that, if that was a problem and you wanted to stop that under the non-compete, you'd have to do the same thing.
Thank you. I think that places the burden on the wrong end of the horse, but nevertheless, thank you.
All right. Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. You gave an example that, to me, it seems like so the employee made a non-compete, agreed to a non-compete agreement when he was first hired with the company, and then the company changes drastically, it seems like, to the point where he doesn't feel comfortable working there. It almost seems like the terms changed and he should be able to back out of it, but I would agree on that premise that he should be able to back out of it because the agreement is it changed. He's not able to continue being there because of the company changing the way it did. And so to me, I like contract that has to be agreed to. I mean, that should be a new non-compete agreement brought in if that was the case, and then he would have the opportunity to back out. I think I agree in that situation. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but there were agreements, and my point is it has to go both ways too. So when the company changes, then I would agree in that case there should be the opportunity to back out. But if it hadn't, he did agree to it, and I guess I have an issue with that.
Now, Mr. Chair, Senator, that by nature, non-compete agreements are boilerplate unless they're at an executive level, and they're pretty much for most people coming to work for somebody. It's just they're there. It's just one of those documents that you have to sign when you sign it for work. And I guess you could make the case to say, yes, they did indeed sign it. But there's a lot of things that people are asked to sign that probably are not good policy.
All right, any other questions or comments? Lee, thank you very much. What I'm going to do Chair, at this point.
Excuse me?
I was going to say what I'm going to do at this point is I'm going to close the, not close, I'm going to recess this bill, which is Senate Bill 977, we'll come back and take testimony. I want to make certain we do things in order today. And I know that Senator Courtney is also going to be coming down at some point. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to go back up to the top of the agenda on the public hearings, and we're going to go ahead and take testimony. As I mentioned, we've had 315. No one else is here. So the next one that we have is Senate Bill 897. I'm going to open it up for public hearing. I'm going to have Josh, is this yours? We'll have the summary, and then I need to make a comment on this, and then we'll take testimony at that point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 897 creates a crime of militia terrorism. Applies the crime to a person who, together with two other persons, physically occupies public property, provided that at least one of the other persons remains on the property for more than 48 hours following a lawful direction to leave, and at least one of the occupying persons possesses a firearm. There is a -1 amendment to the bill that makes a number of modifications. The amendment is posted on OLIS. It applies the crime to a person who, together with nine other persons, physically occupies public property, and at least one of the persons remains on the property for more than 48 hours following a lawful direction to leave. At least two of the occupying persons possess a firearm, and at least one of the persons brandishes or openly displays a firearm. The amendment requires the defendant have knowledge of each of these circumstances and punishes as a Class C felony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So my statement here is that Senate Bill 897 was introduced at the request of a former member, Charlie Ringo. Apparently there's been a death in his family, so he is not here today to give testimony. I do know there are a number of individuals that have signed up to testify. I'm willing to take that testimony. I also want to let you know at this point the chair is not inclined to move the bill forward, meaning we're not looking at it going forward. This was a opportunity to have a discussion that as to issues that Farmer Senator Ringo wanted to put on the record and have for open more discussion. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and call up. I've got, it looks like, six individuals who want to give testimony. Again, please remember at this point, the chair is inclined not to be moving the bill forward, but we'll be more than willing to take your testimony since you have come here today, and that way it will be part of the record. And if Senator Ringo is able to have his schedule to come in and make his statements, that will be part of the record as well. So with that said, I'll call up Philip Watson. I believe it is Thomas Lewis.
Yes.
Okay. And then Julie Collins. If the three of you would please come forward, you'll be our first panel. And as y'all are coming up and getting situated, I'm not sure if you've given testimony before. What we need you to do is put your name on the record and then your testimony. And if you have written testimony, please, and it's been posted, please don't read it into the record because it is already part of the record. Please just give us, you know, the highlights of the your written testimony, or speak from the heart as to why you believe, based on the checking here, we shouldn't go forward with the bill. Okay. And are you Philip?
Yes.
Okay, we'll let you go first.
Thank you, Chairman, distinguished members of the committee. First, I would like to say I'm pleased to hear that consideration is probably not going forward. I submitted a lengthy letter, and you all can read that at your disposal. And I would just like to keep it real short here and say, you know, anything that would infringe on constitutional rights, right to free speech, right to keep and bear arms, is a pretty serious right thing to take away from a citizen. And I realize that Senator Ringo isn't here to give his testimony, but I would definitely say that the bill, as it was written, is very troublesome.
I'm not sure if I heard. Could you put your name on the record if you did?
Yeah, my name is Philip Watson with the Firearms Policy Coalition.
Okay.
And just to wrap up real quick, you know, I met a lot of civil rights leaders just growing up and going to school, and anything that would attack the right to rallies and so forth, I think it would be a very extreme law. And I would encourage, if it would come to a vote, I would encourage all of your no vote. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, Philip. Thomas?
Yes. Yes, I have the same points. Please be aware of the following points regarding the U.S. Constitution.
Thomas, before you get, give us your name, then your testimony.
Yes, it's Samuel Thomas Lewis.
Okay.
And I live in Linn County.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Please be aware of the following points regarding the U.S. Constitution as it relates to SB 897. The First Amendment to the United States Constitution enumerates the God-given right to peacefully assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. The Second Amendment to the United States Constitution enumerates the God-given right for the citizens to bear arms. SB 897 could make it a felony to possess arms at a facility when assembled for the redress of grievances. Such a law would be in violation of both the First and Second Amendments to the Constitution. As a senator or representative, you have sworn an oath to defend the United States Constitution and to vote in favor of SB 897 would be a violation of your oath. And so I call on you to vote against SB 897.
All right.
Okay.
Anything else?
Well, basically, it's not much different from his testimony. It's just that, yeah, I believe that it's...
Well, I appreciate you coming and putting it on the record. If y'all just stay there for a second, we're going to go ahead and take Julie's, and then we're going to ask if anyone has any questions for you. Julie?
Hi, my name is Julie Collins. You know, my mama taught me that you catch more flies with honey, but today I'm going to be kind of blunt. So excuse me for that. This bill absolutely disgusts me. I'm a legal concealed handgun carrier. I can't fight, I can't run, and I refuse to be a victim. As much as I fear for my physical safety, what I really fear more is you all here. You may not be considering this now, but I believe it'll probably be considered in the future. If I exercise my First Amendment right, I can't exercise my Second Amendment right. If I exercise my Second Amendment right, I can't exercise my First Amendment right on public property. I am the public. And if I choose to do both, you will label me a militia terrorist and charge me with a felony. There is nothing written that says I am only allowed to exercise one right at a time, because you might as well arrest me now, because I'm not going to stop doing either. It's obvious to me that this bill is kind of a knee-jerk reaction to what happened in Burns. The majority of knee-jerk reactions are based on emotion, not facts. Militia seems to be the new buzzword for y'all. Would it surprise you to know that there is an actual U.S. code that defines the word militia? If you speak out against government overreach, you're a terrorist. I've stood on these steps outside here numerous times with hundreds of people. Almost everybody carried a weapon. No shots were fired, nobody was injured, and nobody was terrorized. And yet, according to this bill, we would all be militia terrorists. And who exactly does this protect? It doesn't protect me. Isn't that your job, to serve and protect the citizens of Oregon? This bill does nothing more than attempt to make criminals out of citizens, hardworking, tax-paying, voting citizens. This bill is meant to put boots on the necks of people who have something to say, whether you agree with them or not. According to the Constitution, that both of these are our rights. And thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions, comments? Let me just put on the record, as much as you disagree with what someone has put forward, as we all know, that's part of the democratic process.
Exactly.
I mean, we want people to be able to bring their ideas to us and have a discussion and maybe a debate on it, and then make decisions whether we move something forward. So, you know, we need to respect, I guess, everyone as to having that right to do it. Whether we're going to do it is a completely different thing. So thank you all very much for coming forward. And our next panel is going to be, I believe it's Danny Rigdon, Ronnie Daniels, I believe, and then Sam Hill. And while they're coming forward, was there anyone else who did not get signed up for 897 who'd like to give testimony? Okay. We'll get you as soon as we get through with these. Thank you. And gentlemen, whoever would like to start, if you'll just give us your name and then your testimony, please.
Okay. My name is Danny Rigdon, Jr.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm against this bill, you know, basically for the same reasons that were spoken out over there. You know, it's our constitutional right to carry, bear, you know, firearms, and it's also our constitutional right to freedom of speech as well. You know, as the Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia being necessary, the key word here, necessary, to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Let's look at the very definition of militia. It's been split in two. You have an organized and an unorganized militia. There's one that contains members of the National Guard and Naval Militia, and two that composes the reserve militia, being every able-bodied man at least 17 and under the age of 45. That is the very definition of militia. In America, there has always been an ideal about the citizen soldier. Key word here, citizen soldier. We even have a monument erected in 1875 in Concord, Massachusetts, named the Concord Minuteman. He was a citizen soldier. You know, he was part of a militia. That's the whole idea of militia, is that it's not for, it's, you know, it's not to terrorize people. It's not to shoot up a bunch of people. It's just like, I believe her name was Julie said, that was up here, when she said she stood on the court, you know, the steps of the state house here, the Capitol, with firearms, and they weren't terrorizing anybody or anything like that. That's all part of a militia. I mean, you can look at history. Like, let's take a look at the Black Panthers, for instance. The inspiration that Huey Newton and Bobby Seale had from Malcolm X as young Black Panthers, they used firearms in protest for equality. So basically what you're saying is, even if the Black Panthers were here and they did a march with firearms, they don't shoot people up, as history has shown. They march with firearms. So they would be charged with a felony under this rule for doing this, just like any other militia. All right? It's a violation of their rights as well. as long as violence isn't the goal, what is the problem? That's what I don't, you know, I don't understand that. There's even stories, whether true or false, of Attorney General Eric Holder as a freshman at Columbia University in 1970 participating in a five-day armed occupation of an abandoned Naval Reserve office. Under this law, he would have been arrested and charged with a felony. Probably would have never became an attorney general either. Let's see. You know, our founding fathers were pretty specific on this matter, too. As George Washington stated, a free people ought not only be armed but disciplined. That was in his first annual address to both House and Congress, January 8, 1790. And then, of course, Thomas Jefferson has numerous things about people being armed. You know, no free man shall ever be disbarred from the use of firearms, Thomas Jefferson. And then also Thomas Jefferson, the laws that forbid the carrying, that's the key word here, carrying of arms are laws of such a nature they disarm only those who are neither inclined nor determined to commit crimes. Such laws make things worse for the assaulted and better for the assailants. They serve to encourage than to prevent. They serve more to encourage than to prevent crimes. For an unarmed man, a group may be attacked with greater confidence than an armed man. Also, I might add that basically this bill says that, and it wasn't in place before, that the occupation in Burns and what Lavoie Finkham and Ammon Bundy and all those guys were doing was not illegal at the time. So therefore, if that was not illegal at the time, if there was no bill, then where is the justification of the forceful authority within this state that went on? If there was no bill in place for what they did down in Burns, then why were the steps taken that were taken? I that's just something I don't really understand. You guys are representatives of all the people in this state. As you can see that there are individuals here, I haven't seen anybody yet that is for the bill as part of citizens of the state. Maybe you guys are. I don't know. I don't know if you're for or against it. But so far, most of the people here are against it. And you are elected officials. You know, we're here, you know, pleading to you that we just want to keep our rights. Every law that's passed is taking away right. Every law that gets passed takes away an individual's rights. That's all I have to say on the matter. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Danny. Ronnie?
My name is Ronnie Daniels, and I'm from Polk County, Oregon, Sheridan on the Highway 22 side, in the countryside. I'm very honored to be here along with my servants of the people. I'm going to read you something real quick, and then I'll get to my point. It is from Daniel Webster. And keep this in mind. You work for us, the people. Good intentions will always be pleaded for every assumption of authority. It is hardly too strong to say that the Constitution was made to guard the people against the dangers of good intentions. There are men in all ages who mean to govern well, but they mean to govern. They promise to be good masters, but they mean to be masters. I'd like to know where y'all stand on that, because it seems like when we got a budget deficit going on, we got more laws, and we keep adding more laws. It's appalling and wasting my tax dollars, and I have to lose $120 a day so I can come down here to express my dissension of this bill and other things in this House and Senate. I've seen you. I know you, Mr. Denbrough, Mr. Brzezinski. Senator Manning is honored to see you, along with Senator Thatcher and Senator Linthicum. Thank you very much. But at the same time, my point is this bill. Our founding fathers, even as late as the great John Kenyon says, each of us is the militia. The militia is the individual of the person. During Martin Luther King marches, the deacons of justice that was protecting before the Kennedy came along, Dr. King down south through the hell and misery of that time period, they would be breaking the law on this basis. You would, if you want to go through, you want to make this point, whether I agree or disagree. There might be people in the Occupy movement that is expressing their Second Amendment right along with their First Amendment right. There might be people that was in the Black Lives Matter or various other groups, La Raza or anything else. And you're going to go through and put a bill like this, you're indirectly speaking and saying, okay, you can do one, but you can't have another. When our founding fathers and the Constitution, even the Oregon Constitution, which is strengthened the gun laws stronger than the federal, says that we have those endowed rights from our Creator, and no man should be taking them away from us. I speak dissently against this bill. I hope you get this message, because sometimes y'all go through and sneak it through the back door, and it's pretty ironic. As an American and as an Oregonian of 25 years almost, I moved to this state to be part of the nature of this state, not import laws from other states that does not respect the will of the people. Thank you.
All right, Ronnie, thank you very much. Sam.
Yes, my name is David Samuel Hill. I'm from Yamhill County. I come here today to speak from the heart on this matter. The First Amendment and the Second Amendment, as we have all heard, your right to free speech, your right to redress grievances, your right to bear arms, your freedom of assembly. These are very, very important rights. And if we combine them together, if you are bearing arms while exercising your First Amendment, these two should be permitted. To restrict this or to present a law that you could get asked by a law enforcement officer to leave, that could end up restricting your rights at that point in time. I have a legal right through the First and Second Amendment to come down here and speak to you and carry, and I could carry without ever threatening anybody. My carrying a firearm isn't a threat to you as long as I do so appropriately. Now, with that being said, this law is getting very dangerously close to restricting freedoms that we all enjoy as Americans. And I would encourage you to drop the bill where it is, because there are other legal mechanisms to punish people who have criminal intentions and to do harm to either the government or to the population around them. And on top of that, this law, I feel, is a knee-jerk reaction to what 40 or so people did in Eastern Oregon, as where we have 4 million law-abiding, well, most of them are law, the great majority of them are law-abiding citizens that should enjoy and keep their freedoms that they have. Thank you for your time.
Sam, thank you very much. Any questions for anyone? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. Really appreciate you coming forward.
Thank you.
And being part of the process. And the gentleman who raised his hand and wanted, you're not on the list, but please come up and give us your name so we can get you on the list. And hopefully you were here when I made the statement at the beginning.
No.
Okay. Basically, we're taking testimony. The individual that wanted the bill to be heard had a family death. So he is not here. My intention is not to be moving the bill forward.
I did hear that, sir.
Okay. All right. And your name, sir?
My name is Robert Matthews, and I live in Lane County, Oregon.
All right, Robert. Go ahead.
I just want you all to know that I get my rights from God. I'm going to get my rights from you guys. Bills like this that come up should never come up. If it's in violation of our Constitution, it shouldn't even be an issue. It should be thrown out immediately. Why it's not is beyond me. We're paying you guys money to sit up here and do what? Let stuff like this go through. Bills get shoved in. Nobody's even here to represent it. And this goes on all the time. There's all kinds of bills that go through this house that come through that nobody's ever even, they just sign them anonymously and send them in. Let's see if it goes through, guys. BS. It ain't working for me. Okay, let's get back to the Constitution, folks. That's what we're paying you for. Thank you.
All right, Robert, thank you very much for coming forward and giving your testimony. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 897, and that's going to take us to Senate Bill 977. We're going to reopen the public hearing on that to take the testimony of those who had signed up. Betsy Earls, Anthony Smith, and Laura Lana Butterfield. Why don't y'all come on up? We reopen that 977. And while the three of them are getting situated, is there anyone else here today that didn't get signed up that wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 977? All right, who's going to be leading off?
Anthony is.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith, State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. And I know you have a lot to get to today, so I'll try to be as brief as possible. I'm primarily here before you today to just draw attention to a letter that you'll find on OLIS that is actually from one of our small business members who couldn't be here today. And if you hadn't if you have not had a chance yet to review that letter, I would really encourage you to do so. And consider the disruptive impacts that this bill would have on small and independent insurance and financial services firms like his. So please, if you haven't already, please review that letter, give it a read. He explains in very good detail how this is going to directly impact the way that he goes about doing business. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Betsy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Business Association. We have many members that represent, that work in the financial and insurance industries, but we also have many others that are in bioscience, high tech, and other industries where intellectual property and trade secrets are extremely important to the success of the company. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, those situations today. Also, I wanted to bring to your attention that just last session in 2015, the Oregon legislature changed the legal limit on how long non-compete agreements could be enforced for from 2 years to only 18 months. And it's our position that further limiting the scope of non-competition agreements so soon is unfair to the businesses that have invested very heavily in the development of their people and the intellectual property that makes their work a success. In fact, Senate Bill 977 basically takes the non-competition statute as it's written and turns it into nothing more than a non-solicitation statute. Limiting the scope of non-compete agreements in Oregon will have the effect of stifling innovation, and it will make Oregon a much less friendly climate for knowledge-based companies, both those that are established in the state and those that are just trying to get started. As Senator Beyer said, 977 is oriented toward non-competition agreements for employees, not between companies that are being sold, spun off, or divided. But I think everybody here knows that people are the most incredibly valuable assets that most companies have. And Oregon courts have a long history of balancing the interests of employees with the temporal and geographic interests of the company that is seeking to protect their assets. Senator Beyer also mentioned that if this bill passes, employers could still protect their valuable intellectual property by getting an injunction against an employee. Having worked in situations like this in my brief but very interesting law practice past, I want to tell you that I've worked with exactly this situation with high-tech employees. And when a key employee has left a company and they are heading for the airport for their new job with a competitor in Asia, it is incredibly expensive for the client, not to mention a flat-out panic, to get an injunction against that employee going to work for their competitor, even if it's halfway across the world. So I don't think it's fair to say that getting an injunction is a reasonable solution to the problem of avoiding all non-competes in the state. With that said, I just want to talk with you briefly about how non-compete agreements are constructed and interpreted in the state right now. Courts tend to balance two main factors when they're looking at non-compete agreements that end up in front of them. They look at the time that a non-compete agreement is written for, and then they look at the geography, how far out from where the employee worked the company intends to enforce their non-compete agreement. So if you have a company that's in downtown Portland, and they want to enforce a non-compete agreement against an employee just within the Tri-County area, it might be reasonable for that company to want a little bit longer of a time on their non-compete agreement. On the other hand, if you're in a situation like what I just mentioned, where the employee is headed for the airport off to Asia to work for a competitor, that's a long way away. And it's true that many of companies in Asia are direct competitors with our companies in Oregon. Really, the court is going to look at that entire scope of the globe and say, no, your non-compete agreement is not going to work at 18 months, because there's nowhere in the world that the employee can go to make money. And that's just not fair. Even though non-compete, people that are under non-compete agreements in Oregon right now are required to be compensated at some level. So the last thing I want to point out to you is just that the courts in Oregon right now have extremely broad authority when they're looking at non-compete agreements before them to modify them right there in court. They have what's known as blue pencil authority, which basically means that they can rewrite those agreements right there in court if they find them unreasonable based on the factors that they think are most important for that particular employee and employer. When looking at non-compete agreements, really you have heavily fact-dependent situations. Every set of knowledge that an employee has or a company wants to protect is unique from any other, and that's why courts have the kind of latitude that they do in this state. So we think it makes sense to allow the court to have, to continue to have, the courts in Oregon to have the same kind of latitude that they have had for the last many years in Oregon, and we urge you to continue to protect the interests of knowledge-based companies in this state. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Lana?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here on behalf of the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon and Idaho. I'm also representing Roger Beyer, who couldn't be here this morning. He's with the Independent Insurance Agents of Oregon. We are both opposed to Senate Bill 977. I encourage you to read on OLIS the testimony of Mike Bybee. He gives the reason for opposition from the employees, employers, and customers' perspective, and he does a very good job of it. This bill cuts the number of months a former employee cannot contact the employer's customers from 18 months to 6 months. Their customer list is the single most important element of an insurance agency's success, as it is for most businesses. This bill greatly harms small businesses. Insurance laws require agents to receive many hours of education and training, and for the most part, the insurance agency owner pays for that training. The investment in training from an employer represents at least $50,000 before receiving a return on their employee investment. When an employee leaves a firm, an insurance agency firm, and is doing business with the customers, that customer has choice whether or not to continue to that with that relationship. But if he doesn't care, then it will remain with the agency. What happens after 6 months and that employee goes out and starts contacting all those customers that don't really want that kind of solicitation? This bill also harms the customers. 18 months is a much better time. It gives the agency owner and the ex-employee time to talk about how to make the transition and which customers should go where. PIA encourages you to vote no on Senate Bill 977. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Thatcher?
Yeah, I guess I remembered the example that Senator Beyer brought up where an employee agreed at the beginning to work for this insurance agency, but then things changed substantially. Do you agree? I know it would be difficult to figure out how you determine what is a substantial change in policy, but in that kind of scenario, it seems like a non-compete should be able to be broken. I'm just wondering if you have any comments on that. Maybe it is already law. I don't know. I'm not real familiar with this.
Well, I can't speak, excuse me, Mr. Chair and Senator Thatcher, I can't speak to that particular situation, but that ex-employee is free to go out and contact whoever he wants as long as it's not a client of that employer. So he's free to make his way.
All right. Any follow-up on that? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Appreciate you coming in for testimony. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 977. I believe President Courtney is here, so we'll go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 1050. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1050 provides a presumptive sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of release or parole for a defendant sentenced for rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, or unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree if, at the time the crime is committed, the defendant has a prior conviction for one of those crimes or an equivalent crime in another jurisdiction. Senate Bill 1050 has no revenue impact, and we do not yet have the fiscal impact statement. Thank you.
All right. Senator Courtney, and if you'd like to bring up Jessica Menifee and whoever else you might have. Mr. President, when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and Senator Denbrough, Senator Manning, who's not here, Senator Lithicum. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator, District 11, which is parts of Salem and Jervis and Woodburn. I'm here today in support of the Senate Bill 1050. And some of you know, I think probably just one of you knows, that I remember Senate Bill 1517 way back in 2014, in which there was a public hearing before this committee. That was the February session. It was a February session. Then I introduced Senate Bill 2 in 2015. That bill did even less, even worse. It did not even get a hearing. So hopefully maybe this bill, which is a different version of those bills, can maybe do a little better. I introduced this bill and the two previous bills because I have always been concerned about predatory sex offenders. Now, I understand from learned and high counsel who joins me, Counsel Jessica Menifee, as well as Honor Braun in my office, that the term predatory sex offender is no longer used. They do not use the word predator. There is another designation for them. And I'll just defer to your expertise, Mr. Chair, as to the evolution of this type of designation of criminal. But I use it because it's what I first learned about way back years ago. I think it was now well over 20 years when I was the only legislator who volunteered and was on Governor Roberts' commission on sex offenses. And that was the commission which created and introduced the bills that we know today and laws today that involve background checks, sex offender registration, and neighborhood notification. All those bills came out of that commission. And I was heavily involved in it because I was on it. And all those bills, I believe, at one time or another, were taken up before the courts and challenged. Most of them made it. Some of them had to be redone. So I won't say this has been a long time work of mine. In fact, I got away from it for years because it bothered me so much. But I have long felt that we struggle with these kinds of sex offenders, especially when they're doing certain types of crimes to children. So my idea was that if you commit a certain type of crime against a child under 12 and you're an adult, you would get a life sentence. Well, that didn't go so well when I had that bill drafted. I was advised in no uncertain terms, Peter, that's unconstitutional. So that stopped that effort. So then I attempted to say, okay, then maybe we should develop a process that there isn't a life sentence unless there was a vigorous type of sentencing procedure you go through, some of which is akin to a life sentence now given to someone who commits murder. That was also a problem because, in effect, you're saying you commit a crime once, you're going away forever. This basically would say, first of all, you commit, it's a if and then bill. If you commit one of three sex offenses, which have all been outlined for you by your committee administrator, rape in the first degree, sodomy first degree, unlawful sexual penetration. If you do one of those three crimes, and here comes the and, at the time of the offense, you had a prior conviction for rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, or unlawful penetration, or an equivalent federal offense or an equivalent offense in another state, then a presumptive sentence of life without possibility of parole can be given to that individual. It's sort of a two strikes, you're out. Now, I'm not certified smart enough, that's why Learned and High Counsel joins me, to describe exactly what you mean by a presumptive life sentence. I go back and forth on a true life sentence versus a presumptive life sentence, but that is what this crime would do. If you ask me how many times will the district attorneys use it, I have no idea. If you ask me the cost of this bill, Chair, I don't know what it is. I believe it would not be a crime or a sentence. It's not a new crime, as I found out. It is a new sentence, in effect. It's a new sentence. I believe that it would not create a tremendous number of new beds, Your Honor, but I don't know that before you stand. But this has been an incredible effort to try to get this far. It's a totally different variation than when I started out, because I don't get the permanent life sentence. Boom, you commit this crime, you're done, you're going away for life against a kid. Not there. Not going to happen. I get that. So this has been a labor of labor, and so this is, shall we say, I guess my final time to try to create a situation where someone through the legal system is considered this kind of person, this kind of sex offender, and to say that because of the nature of the crimes and because, in my humble opinion, the science is yet to know exactly how to treat these people so that they don't do it again. All the background check stuff and all the registration and notification bills were designed to try to inhibit people from doing this because they know they were being closely watched. In spite of all that, we still struggle with how to deal with individuals like this. So I'm not here to try to play pious or self-righteousness, but the only way I know to stop this from happening at least another time is to have to incarcerate the person for a very, very long time. So that's just a general statement. I have the written statement. I read parts of it. I drop away from it. I am sorry to have to bring legislative counsel up from her very busy schedule. But if you start coming at me with really technical questions, Your Honor, either individually or collectively, you can stump me. But this is not a one-day quickie thing that's before you, as you know, Chair, because you are very much familiar with my efforts here. I started years ago trying to at least do something to maybe take some out of our society, I'm sorry, from being able to do this again to some person. So that's my statement, and I'm sorry that I've come in with a bill this late. I think I have to tell you, this is Originally, when I started out, this was not the bill. This bill has been created in the last 3 or 4 weeks through consultations with very learned counsels, very knowledgeable people about the district attorney's offices, as well as people who know the constitutional law and the criminal justice system.
All right. Thank you. So I'm assuming we have lifelines to your right. They're not going to speak unless we stump you.
Yes, I don't think legislative counsel likes to be called on. It's up to them. They can speak for themselves. Also, Lisa Herzog's office has been monitoring me. She created these beautiful chart, this one-pager, which I love. But basically, my bill now has become a one-pager. If you go back and look at the other two, they were complicated. So, you know, they've worked very, very hard individually and collectively on this bill. It has been a truly a legislative counsel and a staff bill in my office, which have been as critical of what I've been trying to do as anybody, and yet they work with me, to try to make sure I stay within the constitutional as well as within really what is going on in the world of sex offenders or however you want to describe them. So that's what they're here for. Should you want to ask questions that I can't answer?
All right. Let's see if we have any questions for the president.
Well,
I'm glad someone does.
Well, I'm only saying this because I didn't want him to feel like he wasted people's time coming up here. Yeah. But I had a bill that was very similar to that. I was getting drafted, and it didn't come out quite right. And then I heard you were doing something along this line, so I didn't pursue it. But I like this bill. I really do. I liked your first one. But I understand we can't quite go there. Yeah. But, yeah, there's a little problem with that. That's just the vengeful side of me like that. But anyway.
I set that thing over the side.
But if there is a conviction, it's only if there is a conviction prior. So if somebody's in court and they're being accused or they actually get convicted of two rapes in the first degree. This would not apply because it would have to have had a prior conviction, yeah. Correct?
The clarification there is that it takes a conviction that's a standalone, separate from being able to compound or doubling up. If someone was charged with multiple crimes at the same time, you would not be able to use this as a stacking type. It requires a conviction outright and then another incident after that.
Counsel, could I have?
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, that's correct. It is sort of a true prior conviction where you have to already be convicted of it before the new offense is committed.
And Mr.
And
Chair.
Jessica Menefee from Legislative Council, sorry.
Thank you. Could you also explain briefly what presumptive is versus true?
Sure. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher. Presumptive sentence is the sentence that somebody would receive from a judge unless the judge chooses to impose a downward departure based on substantial and compelling reasons for the departure. So if there are other reasons why this person should get less than a true life sentence, then a judge could impose that. But the presumptive sentence is just what it sounds like. It's what the person would normally receive.
So following up, if you remember, we have the sentencing guidelines, and it has that chart, and it has the different months.
I don't have it memorized, sir.
Okay, but if you remember that concept, those are the presumptive sentences or what's in those boxes for sentencing guidelines. Then on the back, if you look at it, there are aggravating and mitigating factors that can be argued to change that sentence from what is presumed to be the sentence to take it up or to take it down, and this is modeled after the same concept. So we know that an individual who is charged with this is the presumption you will get this sentence unless something else happens that the court's going to have to put on the record and identify based on facts, which can be appealed by either side. All right. Senator Denbrough.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a follow-up to that. I'm wondering what the practice is now for someone who lands in this kind of situation. And then I'm also wondering, the bill talks about prior conviction for a specified sex crime. So does that mean that they've been convicted of the same crime or some other sex crime? I mean, what exactly is that prior conviction for?
Chair Przanski, Senator Denbrough, as far as what kind of sentence somebody would receive right now, you really need to look at this bill in context with several other statutes that are current law. One of them provides for a presumptive life sentence on the third offense, but that includes any sex crime, not just these first-degree crimes that are described in the bill. There's also another statute that provides for a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence for a second conviction, and that is limited to the crimes described in subsection 3, so rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, but there's also a fourth one, using a child in a display of sexually explicit conduct. And again, that's the 25-year mandatory minimum. There's also something called Jessica's Law, which is sort of an add-on to Measure 11, which provides for a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence for certain crimes if the victim is under 12 years old. So all of those are current law right now.
So in effect, if I can jump in, so this takes a 25-year mandatory minimum and makes it a life sentence.
Senator Przanski, or Chair Przanski, Senator Denbrough, it does change what would normally receive a 25-year mandatory minimum, and now the person is receiving a presumptive life sentence, assuming that the crimes are the same under each scheme. And also the previous conviction is slightly different how that is calculated as well. But the person, a person who is subject to this bill is probably already subject to the 25-year mandatory minimum. Not always, but probably. And I think you had another question about the prior convictions. It can be any of the prior convictions listed in subsection 4, so that's lines 17 to 23 of the bill. Any one of those will increase to a life sentence the sentence for anything listed in subsection 3 of the bill.
And I guess I have a follow-up for the president, and that's just a question of is there any evidence that the 25-year minimum that presumably somebody would be subject to is inadequate? I know it's kind of speculative because that minimum probably hasn't been in effect long enough for someone to have actually served 25 years, but, you know, the concern that people are getting out or will get out prematurely after 25 years.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Denver, is there any evidence? There was a case. The trouble is I don't want to mislead the committee. Factually, where there was, and it was here, someone, it seems to me, was a multiple sex offender, and they had just struck again and involved a child. But again, I don't know whether that relates to you or not. That is what actually spawned my thinking on this. So I don't want to say, is there, when you say any evidence, you know, that's a question, since I'm in front of an august judiciary committee, I don't want to mess around with and say this is what the evidence is. Clearly, I am also making a public policy statement with this bill regarding the magnitude of these individuals and how serious a threat they are. Either you accept that or you don't in terms of whether or not they'll do their acts again. So I cannot specifically answer your question in a guaranteed way to satisfy you, because you are a professor and intellectual, and I don't want to, without that kind of research, I'm really scared about answering your question, absolutely. But I wish I could recall now the case was out of Washington, an individual who truly had been at it for a long while, and he struck again, and it was not good. And I said, how can this be? Because I understand I had learned from talking to the chair about the many laws that Learned and High Counsel just described to you that are already on the books, that I would have thought that those laws somehow or other would have made sure this person wasn't out. Now, whether the 25 years is not really 25 years in early release, that's another whole thing. That's why this true life sentence versus presumptive life sentence, those are very interesting terms. You understand what I'm saying. Sometimes you give a person a life sentence, we all know they don't necessarily stay in for life. Here, I wanted to be absolutely sure they weren't getting out. So that's all I can say. I can't answer the question without doing some independent research and coming back to you the way I would like to answer the question.
All right. Any other comments? Senator Lithicum?
With regard to your last answer, there still are in this presumptive life sentence without parole. There's parole or probation. There's still mitigating circumstances and aggravating factors, et cetera. Is that true?
Yeah. Chair Brzezinski, can I now refer to counsel on that? Because this is something that I really learned a lot from learned it in High Legislative Council. So you respond to that, because that is a very profound question regarding this life sentence.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Linthicum, that is right. That a judge could take into account mitigating factors, and if one or more of those mitigating factors constituted substantial and compelling reasons for a downward departure, a judge could sentence a person to less than a life sentence.
So the point here basically is there's a discretion with the court. You know, traditionally we've always have had the court make a decision on a case-by-case basis. It hasn't been, except for the last, I'm going to say, 20-plus years, mm-hmm. where we've seen a push for mandatory minimum type of sentencing. 1994 is when Measure 11 was passed. That's established, really, for this state, I think, the first broad mandatory minimum type of sentencing structure. And so what this bill actually does, it kind of returns back to the point of where a judge, he or she, makes a decision based on an individual case, the facts, and the circumstances, and it says we, as a society, believe that this is the appropriate sentence to be given, but you, as a judge, have the authority to make these changes based on finding in the court and putting on the record. All right, so I'd like to get moving.
Yeah,
so
I just have one question, Mr. Chair, and that is that the judge currently has discretion to raise the penalty, doesn't she or he? I mean, there's a mandatory minimum in most cases of 25 years, but they could do a higher if the conditions warranted it.
If the factors are there, they have to actually, in the sense of, I mean, there's a mandatory, let me start over. There's the presumptive sentence, and then there are a set of aggravating as well as mitigating factors that the parties can argue as to what and why they think something should be different than the presumptive sentence. Counsel?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dembrough, I just wanted to add, It would be difficult for a judge to give more than that 25-year mandatory minimum sentence unless there were multiple crimes, and then the court can impose consecutive sentences, and that's often what you would see. The 25-year mandatory minimum is already outside of the guidelines, and I'm trying to think of a situation where a judge could impose more.
No, that's
one,
true.
One thing to point out, though, that person would be on lifetime post-prison supervision.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. This is outside of the bounds of a true sentencing guideline type of sentence. All right. If there's no other comment or questions, we have one other witness, I believe, that's going to give testimony.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You bet. Thank you very much, Mr. President. I've got Gil Meyer. Now, I also, Pamela Brawl, it looks like you've signed in, but it says not testifying, so I just want to make sure that you didn't want to testify. All right, thank you. Is there anyone else besides Gil Meyer who wants to testify today on 1050? Gil, if you can give us your reduced concise version so we can get into work sessions, that'd be great.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The Legislative Committee of OCDLA discussed this bill yesterday and voted to be neutral on it, and we'd like to explain the reasons why. The framework and structure of Senate Bill 1050 is far superior to the framework and the structure of most other repeat offender laws. You've been discussing this amongst yourselves, but this is what we would call a true repeat offender custody cycle example. This means that someone commits a crime, there's been an intervention, they've been arrested, they've been brought through the system, they've been prosecuted, convicted, and they've been punished. Then they come out and repeat again. That's what we consider to be the true repeat offender, which is distinguished from other repeat cycle statutes that we do have, where offender, you see this a lot on the drug and property side, they offend, finally get busted, and then in one sentencing proceeding, they're considered a repeat offender. So we consider this to be a true repeat cycle bill, and we think that that's where the emphasis should be. It also leaves and puts the sentencing discretion with the sentencing judge, which is actually where we think it needs to be as well. With most mandatory minimum laws, it removes any discretion from the judges, and because power abhors a vacuum, it has to go somewhere, and it goes straight into the hands of the prosecutor. So by allowing the court to look at departure factors for something other than a life sentence is where we think the discretion needs to be. Those might look like low mental acuity of the accused. Maybe the defendant was fit enough to stand trial, but of low mental abilities. They may have been not a principal participant in the crime, but more an aider and abettor. You can imagine some scenarios where a court might just simply feel there's a basis there for some mitigation. And finally, these crimes deal with the worst of the worst. These really are the worst of the sex crimes. And so it's saying that if you've commit the worst of the worst once, you've been punished, and you commit the worst of the worst again a second time, that then the presumptive sentence would set in. All of these features are not present in our other three strikes and you're out statute. That applies to any sex crime that is a felony, and it allows for all of that repeat cycle stuff to be considered in one sentencing proceeding. We've actually had offenders sent to prison for life when they were for public indecency that got into the felony stage because of repeat cycle of that. So we think that's the bad way to do it. This by framework has, we think, the emphasis in the right places. We do note that whoever is the unfortunate lawyer to be defending an individual in this sense is going to, though, be facing somebody, facing life imprisonment. We think there are, before you can have outcome faith in the outcome of a trial to the point where you put someone away for life, you have to make sure that your procedures during the trial itself are fair and balanced. Your grand jury vote's coming tomorrow. We would suggest that a good place to get started. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Gil? Bill, thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 1050. All right, we're getting ready to start our work sessions, but I do want to go ahead and make a comment. I know there are a couple individuals that gave testimony that's still here on Senate Bill 897. That bill will not be scheduled in the future. That bill is not going forward at this time. So I just want to make certain you know that we will not be taking any additional testimony or scheduling it for a work session. So that bill is, as we would call, not going forward. It's dead. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and start with our work sessions. And let's see, we don't have Whitney here, so what I want to do is, how do we want to start? Okay. All right, so while we are waiting for council to get back, I'm going to go ahead and start with the work session on Senate Bill 1041. Josh, why don't you give us a overview on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1041 directs the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to study, track, and account for public monies appropriated for and expended on drug and alcohol treatment and report back to the Interim Judiciary Committee no later than September 15th of 2019. Senate Bill 1041 has no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact. We're getting that posted on OLIS right now, so I think you'll need a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right. So,
yeah. We do have the paperwork?
I think we have the paperwork. All right. And so did you say we had an amendment on that one? I couldn't remember.
No, it's the introduced version.
Yeah. So 1041 is ready to go as is, and we will do the subsequent.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1041 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 1041 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and also moves that it be sent to Ways and Means based on prior reference. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. Senate Bill 1041 is on its way to Ways and Means. And we'll close the work session on 1041. And Josh, what else do you have in the sense of? All right. So we have, as everyone is here, understands that we had multiple bills that have been before us this week. Some of them were carried over for a set date, but even though they were set for the future dates, they had to be carried over. So we're going to carry two of them over because we still are waiting for either paperwork or they were preset to be heard on the next day. Today is the 11th, so we'll be carrying over Senate Bill 59A as well as Senate Bill 95A until tomorrow. So they will be carried over until the 12th of 13th. Yes, I agree. No, so I said, wait, that's not right. So they are being carried over to the 13th. So 59A and 95A are carried over till tomorrow, which is Thursday the 13th. And we're going to take a moment just to make sure we get those written down. All right. And all right. And okay. All right, so we're going to go ahead and jump down where while we're doing this, since we got some of the paperwork on another bill while we're here, we think we may get a couple more that might come in. And so the next one we're going to take up will be Senate Bill 693. So we'll open up a work session on 693.
I know. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. You previously heard about Senate Bill 693 on April 5th. We also heard a little bit more on some invited testimony yesterday. It removed several license suspensions that are unrelated to traffic offenses, such as for littering. We also heard about the Dash 2 amendment that removes the repeal of certain license suspensions, such as for minor possession of alcohol. There is no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact, and we would need to add a subsequent to Ways and Means on the Dash 2.
All right, so we have the Dash 2s that still need to be incorporated. I'm going to ask Senator Dembro, we're ready to go forward if you don't have any other issues at this point. All right, so let's go ahead and move the Dash 2s, please.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 693.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 693. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 693 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
No.
It was not
by prior reference. We would have to be requesting a subsequent request. Ways and Means.
I withdraw that. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 693 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the committee, Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 693 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation and also requesting that the President's office consider referring the bill to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Senator Deverell.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just, I think that this bill is, as amended, is a good start. I think we still have, there's more work, I think, more discussion on this. But I think taking a start at removing suspensions for issues that have nothing to do with driving, I think is something that is a good thing, and I think there's more that we could do with it, but this is a good start.
All right, thank you. Any other comments? And I agree that this is going to say not the beginning, but it is a continuation of the work that's been done. And Senator Denbrough, as well as Senator Winters, I do expect that y'all will be watching the results on this and also looking at other opportunities to ensure we have the appropriate sanctions for the appropriate conduct. All right. Any other comments? Any objections to the motion? So order. And 693 is on its way to Ways and Means. And at this point, we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 722.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. We heard about Senate Bill 722 yesterday, and if you also recall, it was originally 722 was based on Senate Bill 337, which you heard on February 20th. 722 with the dash 2 amendment allows a fee of no more than $100 for debt management service provider who improves or preserves a consumer's credit history. It also allows a consumer to avoid a contract for debt management services and receive reasonable attorney fees in certain circumstances. It applies to agreements entered on or after the operative date. There is a minimal fiscal and a minimal revenue impact.
All right.
Dash 2s. All right. Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 722.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 722. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 722 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 722 as amended by the dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
At first, when I looked at this bill, I thought it was like a restriction that was a new restriction, but it sounds like it is something that industry wants. I'm still a little perplexed as to why it's limited at this particular fee level and then only gets approved after DCBS looks at it to have a fee increase. It's kind of unusual to me, I guess.
Yeah, I unfortunately have no commentary as to
you have commentary on everything, Mr. Chair.
I usually do.
What's going on?
This is one of those, they stumped us, and, if we want to bring up Rick Blackwell, he's here. And that might be able to give
that
a little
might
bit
help
more.
Clarify things.
That puts something on the record, and so we'll call in a lifeline, DCBS. Rick, thank you for being in the room.
Of course, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager with the Division of Financial Regulation. And as to the question, is this a cap on the allowable fees that are charged by? Well, so the bill in 2009 did establish fee caps for the umbrella services known as debt management, which is settlement. So when people take money and try to settle for pennies on the dollar, if possible, doesn't always work very well. Credit counseling, credit repair. Unfortunately, in the law is drafted, credit repair and counseling, which is the subject of this bill, was overlooked. And so actually this is providing within the framework of the fee caps that were established back in 2009, a way for those folks to be able to make a reasonable living, basically.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Senator Lithicum.
Can I ask another question with regard to debt management service provider may charge more than 100 but not more than 120 for the fee? This sounds like a narrow band, and there isn't a time frame associated with it, like per year, per month, per incident, per contract, whatever. And so it has me confused.
Chair Przanski and Senator Linthicum. So the idea there would be, depending on how intensive the work is, what the credit repair folks do with their clients, we could, by rule, determine that intensive work probably does warrant more reasonable rate of return in terms of higher fees. And so we would do this through prior notice, get the folks, get stakeholders together to make sure that we've scoped that appropriately.
And still the language more than 100 but not more than 120 is a very narrow window.
Chair Przanski, Senator Linthicum, that is correct, though again, we are operating under this framework of services in this particular area of financial products and services are already capped because of the special the concerns back in 2009 and still going on as to the risk for consumer harm. So,
okay. Any other questions? Any objections to the motion that's before us? Not seeing any, so ordered. And the measure passes. It's on its way to the floor. And who did we have a carrier in the sense of one of the members? What is this, a member's bill?
Well, just a moment, Chair Przanski. Look, because it wouldn't be on 722 since that was a placeholder, but
yeah.
337 was by the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation.
All right. Sounds like Lee Beyer is going to be our carrier on this bill. Senator Beyer will be the carrier. Chair will back up if necessary, but Beyer will be primary, and I will only step in if necessary. So with that, we'll close the work session on that one, which was 722. And we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 844.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. You previously heard Senate Bill 844 on March 28th. Deals with the collection of inmate trust account funds for a transitional fund and payment of financial obligations. We now have in the dash one amendment, which does kind of a simple technical fix about what fees are applicable in this program. It does have a fiscal impact, so we do need to add a subsequent to Ways and Means. There was no prior reference to the Ways and Means, and there is a minimal revenue impact.
Which amendment was that, dash one?
I think it was one.
Dash one.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill. Oh, which
top,
one was it?
Top of my page.
Thank you. Senate Bill 844.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash one into Senate Bill 844. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 844 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request a referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 844 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation and request the president to consider a referral of the bill to Ways and Means. Discussion? Senator Thatcher?
Yeah, I think I had some concerns with the existing language. I guess I haven't had a chance to really look at the dash ones yet that well, because it's kind of hard to put the two together. So I'm reserving my yes-no vote for later and being no for now. Does that make sense?
Okay.
I object. I don't like the priorities that are set forth within the bill. I think the state takes their priorities first, level one. Level two is child support, and level three are other civil judgments. I'd like to see child support go to number one if we really care about that.
Senator, I don't have the bill open in front of me, but I believe that is current law now. I think, and I'm going to ask counsel just to look to see if this is a different schedule, because the state has, in fact, put in a distribution for payment of fines and monies that come in through a court order, and I would assume that they're working off that. But if, and it looks like I've got a nod from DLC that that's correct. So your position's acknowledged. I just want to put on the record that this isn't something new and different. It's what they're. Okay. With that, so I believe, let's go ahead and call. Let's make sure. I think it's a 3-2 here.
Senator Dembrough?
Aye.
Senator Linthicum?
No.
Senator Manning?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Pozanski?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. The bill's on its way to Ways and Means. And Senator Linthicum, one of the things I would suggest is that maybe during the interim, you may want to look at this issue as to what the schedule is currently in for distributions and see whether or not you want to entertain some discussions about maybe redefining or modifying the current list.
Okay.
All right. With that, I think I've closed it, but I'm going to go ahead and close 844 again. All right. So now at this point, we have the ones that are at the bottom of the agenda, and I guess I'll just go ahead and say those and come back. Well, let's do it this way. So at this point, I'm carrying over the bills that are on the back page of the agenda, starting with Senate Bill 261, will be carried over till tomorrow, 413. Senate Bill 360 will also be carried over till tomorrow, 413. Senate Bill 494 will also be carried over to tomorrow, 413. Senate Bill 525 carried over till tomorrow, 413. Senate Bill 767 also carried over till 413. All right, so I'm going to do that so we got those squared away. And then we're going to go back to the top of the agenda. These are the bills that we heard with public hearing and with possible work sessions. The bills that we heard, with the exception of 897, are going to be carried over. They will be carried over until tomorrow. So for the record, Senate Bill 315 is carried over until tomorrow, Thursday the 13th. Senate Bill 977, same carry over till tomorrow, 413. Senate Bill 1050, carried over until tomorrow, 413. As I mentioned, Senate Bill 897 is no longer going to be with us. It is now will be removed from the agenda and is not being carried over. That leaves us with the work sessions that we started this morning. Earlier, and I just want to put on the record again, we have Senate Bill 59A carried over until tomorrow, 413. Senate Bill 95A carried over until 413. I'm going to jump down. Let's see. We have 356 we're going to come back to, and I want to make sure the others. We have, So those two are carried over to 413. We've already passed out 693. That's going to Ways and Means. Senate Bill 722 is also passed out with Senator Beyer being our carrier there. And we have Senate Bill 844 that was passed and going to Ways and Means. And Senate Bill 1041 also is on its way to Ways and Means. That leaves the last bill that we have for work session, Senate Bill 356. I'm going to open up a work session on 356. I'm assuming we don't have the paperwork. And so Senate Bill 356 will also be carried over till tomorrow, Thursday, April 13th. And then we're going to let Lisa do her cross checks, make sure we've responded to each of these.
I need to know the carrier on 844.
844 is going to Ways and Means. So I have only one bill designated for carrying to the floor, which is 722. The others that passed out, 693, 844, and 1041, are all on their way to Ways and Means.
Yes.
All right. I think that takes care of us. Senator Linthicum.
Can I have a confirmation of my vote on 722? Chair Przanski, if I can ask for permission to change that to a no.
All right. Senator Lutkin has asked for permission to change his vote on 722. What I'm going to do is I'm going to reopen a work session on 722. And I'm going to ask, is there anyone that has an objection for us to reopen 722 for the purpose of considering the vote that was taken this morning and passing the bill? Not seeing any objection. We have now reopened 722 for the vote that we've taken. And Senator Lithicum, did you want to modify the vote that you had before?
Yes, I'd like to change my vote on 722 to a no.
All right, Senator, Senator Lithicum is changing his vote on 722 to a no. I believe that will give us is that also a 3-2?
4-1.
4-1. Okay, 4-1. All right. With that, is there any other individual who wants to modify that vote on that bill? Not seeing.
Mr. Chair, I did say it was going to be a no, so somehow
that's what
in
I
the
thought.
Discussion. So okay. I somehow
yeah, I
missed.
Thought yeah. That's why I asked, and I thought that was all right. So what I understand, and just to make certain, the reason we allowed that because it's not going to change the outcome of the vote that we had previously, but we now have a vote on 722, which is 3-2, still a majority for the motion. The bill is going to the floor. With asking Senator Beyer to be the carrier, and if not, the chair will carry. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close for today. We'll be back tomorrow, and colleagues, as you can imagine, we're continuing to carry stuff over. Tomorrow will be a very full day of work sessions and a few other public hearings. With that, we're adjourned for the day.